from underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who's nice to cooperate with the president.
Brian Fleming is a film director and playwright. He studied English at the University of California, Irvine. He worked as a script reader for New Line Cinema while making his first feature film, Hang Your Dog in the Wind. Fleming's profile out as an indie film director took a huge leap with his second feature film, a FAU documentary about the assassination of Bill Gates called Nothing So Strange in 2002. In addition to working in film and theater, Fleming is an activist on copyright issues. He founded the organization Free Cinema, which encourages feature filmmakers to make their films under two rules. No money may be spent on the production, and the film must be copylefted, which means the film must be released without a copyright. Fleming is also the owner and operator of Fair Use Press, which distributes ebooks attacking public figures such as Bill O'Reilly and Arnold Schwarzenegger for their use of intellectual property law. He created a radio documentary, The Rabbi versus Larry Flint, in 1999 about a debate on pornography between the rabbi and Larry Flint. He maintains a daily personal weblog at www.slumdance.com/blogs/Brian_Fleming/. Or you can just search for Brian Fleming on the internet, on Google, and you'll find it.
All right, Brian, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right, great.
Now everybody knows all about me.
Well, or at least what we assembled.
Well, I just found out about you like 2 days ago, but I'm very interested. There's a movie out right now that you have called The God Who Wasn't There.
That's right.
And first of all, what inspired you to make this documentary? It's about Jesus, isn't it? And
it is. It's first about the theory that Jesus Christ, in fact, never existed, and he began as a legendary figure and was only made a historical figure well after the fact, later in Christian history. The movie explores that theory, a theory that I think is very sound. I think it's most likely that Jesus never existed. And then it goes on to explore how Jesus is used today by the Christian right and what Christianity essentially looks like today. It's a very critical movie of modern Christianity as well as historical Christianity.
Yeah, I read actually on your weblog somebody that didn't like the movie apparently and wrote some very nasty comments about it. Showing his true Christian spirit there.
I immediately later on in the evening, I posted another Christian response just to show not all Christians respond with, I'd love to take a knife and gut you, which is pretty much a quote from that other one.
Yeah.
Some Christians have issues with the film, but they're much nicer about expressing it. I do get quite a bit of the other kind, though.
Yeah, I read the other one, and the other one was much more in-depth and much more nice and didn't actually criticize you. It more criticized almost Christians for themselves not being aware of it and not, letting this happen to them, basically.
Yeah, Christians are surprised when they see the movie because, I mean, essentially the movie presents facts that are indisputed in some ways. And obviously it's disputed whether Jesus existed or not, but the basic Christian history that's provided in the beginning of the movie is not really disputed by Christian scholars or non-Christian scholars or anybody. It's just the basic facts of the Christian religion. And they're really basic. They're very important as far as the development of the religion in its early years. And, about 90% of people who call themselves Christians are completely unaware of these basic facts about their religion. They're just amazingly ignorant about their own religion. And many Christians find the movie to be an eye-opener in that way. And that other review that you talked about, the nicer one, the Christian who wrote it talked about being, shaken as she was driving home, and then the movie left her, sort of in an emotional state that was very confusing to her. And that is a common response to the movie because it just reveals these plain facts that are plain facts and Christians don't know them.
Well, I mean, the whole how deeply some of these people are into their religion is very, very strongly. And I mean, in the movie, you caught people coming out of a Billy Graham thing and like asking them just basic questions, and like they kept, they seem to be tripping up on like some basic stuff that they should probably know about their, the religion that they're so into, and they're willing to go to Billy Graham to like get it, get his version of it, anyways. And it seemed it seemed like almost they were hurting themselves. And but I guess one thing I noticed in the movie was that you didn't really you had like lots of people, like you didn't have like both sides very well represented in a way, because you didn't have like, you know, the evangelical psychos like John Hagee or anything on there talking about his side of the thing and you know, showing you a huge map of like how the rapture will work and all these things. And I mean, that's, I actually caught that from the nice review of the movie from the Christian, and she mentioned that like you only showed like one side, which was like the bumbling kind of like Christians that like had like really nothing to say, and they just kind of go there because they, you know, they love Jesus, but they don't really know why they love him or why they should.
So would the mean Christians talk to you?
Well, the movie does present several Christians, and I let them talk at length without cutting. I rarely, yeah, I was very, very careful about just letting Christians speak for themselves in the movie. And I think some Christians, when they watch the movie, are rather upset because of how Christians come off when they talk about Christianity and that they don't know anything about it. You know, I didn't really, you know, I didn't distort anything to make them appear that way. And I did talk to a wide variety of Christians. They just don't come off all that well. What I didn't do is talk to the people who are, you know, liberal Christians, moderate Christians who are, you know, expert at appearing on television and that sort of thing. I didn't talk to those people because it's rather useless to hear them talk. They just talk in circles, and I didn't want to use up documentary time with that kind of thing. And as far as the documentary is a point of view, and it's my point of view, it's more of an op-ed piece than it is a front-page news story. You know, it's not an unbiased look at Christianity. It's Christianity from my point of view as an ex-fundamentalist Christian who has experience there and as someone who's very critical of Christianity today. And it's about pointing out that Jesus probably didn't exist and pointing out problems in current Christianity more than it is presenting an entire survey of Christianity. I do, though, include several minutes of the most popular Christian movie by far ever made, The Passion of the Christ. And I think that's one of the most disturbing things about the movie for a lot of people.
That is indeed.
And actually, in the movie, you mentioned that you used that without permission. Have you been mentioned? Have like they contacted you or tried to bully you about using that without permission?
No, I'm using several scenes from the movie essentially under the fair use doctrine, which allows quoting of other works for the purpose of a comment or criticism. And since the movie clearly is commenting and criticizing The Passion of the Christ and what it meant to Christians, they don't really have much of a case. They could try to, you know, threaten me into buckling, but I've sent out signals, very strong signals, that I'll fight if Mel Gibson sues. I'll fight as hard as I can. And I think he knows he'll lose and therefore isn't, you know, wanting to give me any publicity by making this this attempt to sue me.
I see. You mentioned that you are an ex-fundamentalist Christian. What made you change your mind?
I started thinking. It's really that simple. I was sort of trapped in this fundamentalist Christian world when I was going to school there, and it's sort of a 24/7 bubble that I was in where I wasn't taught anything else. And as soon as I really got out into the outside world and realized how poorly it aligned with the representation of that world I was given in the school, and I started actually, you know, testing the ideas that I was taught there and learning about things like evolution and learning that gay people weren't evil. And I, you know, just I kept learning new things about the real world that I could verify that didn't align with what I was told. And finally, I realized that the entire thing was just a crock, that, you know, there really was nothing to this supernatural madness that I was taught by Christians. And I just rejected it. So it's thinking, really. I don't really think that you can remain a believer after you've thought about your beliefs.
Well, considering you made this a film, I'm wondering, do you think Christianity is actually hurting us more than helping us as a society?
I do. I think that it would be wrong not to acknowledge the good that many Christians do and the charitable instincts that they have. And I mean, I think they're just good people who have charitable instincts, and they would express them whether there was a religion to express them through or not. You know, they would be going and doing charitable things, whether it's at a church or just another building, to let them do good things. So I don't credit the religion with the good things, but I do want to say that I do know that there's many Christians out there who do good things. But overall, this first century mindset, this first century science that people are locked in, is holding us back in a very significant way from progressing. And the harm that religious rhetoric does in the national dialogue, and how you can just invoke it anytime you want to make a point, and you can polarize a conversation and make people shut up just by bringing up a religious dimension to an issue. This is extremely harmful to our national dialogue, and we shouldn't tolerate it. And I definitely don't. When people, I confront people when they bring up their own personal religious madness that they should be keeping in their home or their church and not bringing out in the public square where it really has no business. I tend to point out how bizarre religious talk is in that context, and I think that's what we need to do. We need to get, you know, all this whole religious thing, whether it's Christ or Islam or any kind of supernatural madness, we need to get that out of the public square so we can solve the serious problems our society has to solve.
Well, religion really is, I mean, it's the whole thing is based on faith, and they don't really have the proof to back it up. And so in this case, like the recent debate that's going on is the intelligent design, which is just creationism, basically. But they're now pressing it forward and trying to, you know, say that it somehow has a legitimate cause or a legitimate, like, because the universe is so complex that it couldn't have possibly been created by, you know, evolution, by anything, you know, like...
Anything scientific?
Right. Anything that can be proven in, like, a state where we can, like, control things so we can, like, in a system, basically.
Yeah, and think about what a huge waste of time that entire trial and all of the incidents that go on with regard to intelligent design. Tens of millions of dollars getting poured into foundations like the Discovery Institute and other intelligent design. All of these people working hard, and the scientists have to gather their energies and work to fight them. School boards get taken over. It eats up the national... All for this crock, this fantasy story that deserves to be ranked along with Roman literature and Greek literature and all of the similar, you know, the stories we have no problem calling fantastical, this book of Genesis. You know, this belief in this magical book called the Bible and that the book of Genesis actually represents something other than the literature of the time written by people who were ignorant about how the world really worked. That's what it is. Just because there are people today who believe that it's something else, tens of millions of dollars and hundreds upon thousands of hours of very important people's work is being eaten up doing that. Imagine the good we could have done with all of that money and all of that energy.
In the movie, you mention how there, before Jesus even, there were several other savior type figures in history that basically had the same, like, did the same things, had like the same experiences, were crucified or, you know, killed on a tree or in some way, you know, sacrificed for the greater good, or came back in 3 days, were sold out for, what was it, 30 some silver pieces, and all this, and this happened way before. And the Christian explanation of this is that Satan planted these before they happened to, you know, so that when Jesus actually came, we wouldn't know. And is this still the theory? Is this still what we are using now to explain?
It essentially is. What we're in a situation now where most Christians are ignorant of the fact that the Jesus story is a near clone of similar stories that existed long before Jesus, and that there's not a single original element in the Jesus story, you know, as far as being born in a manger and wise men coming and doing miracles and being killed on a cross and then rising again after 3 days. I mean, virtually every Savior God died and then rose again, and it was usually after 3 days. It's all built on the winter solstice and on the other astrotheological religions that came long, long before Christianity. Most Christians today, however, don't know this. And so nobody ever has to deal with the fact that this is a plain fact, that the Jesus story is completely unoriginal. However, back in the day, back in the 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century, around then, Christian leaders had to deal with this all the time because those other religions were still around. There were people worshiping Attis. There were people worshiping Mithras and these other religions of the extremely violent Roman Christian church event, you know, killed. They literally killed the people who followed those religions and destroyed those previous religions with violence. Back before that happened, before Christianity had the strength to kill the other religions, the representatives of these other, sometimes more powerful religions said, "Hey, your Christ story, it's just a clone of our story. You just copied us." And the response from the Christian leaders, and the highest Christian leaders, I mean, some of the fathers of the church we're talking about here, was, "Yes, it is similar. However, your religion was created because Satan counterfeited our religion thousands of years in advance." And that's how they rationalized it back then. Obviously, today we don't hear a lot of that, but that's really because Christians today are utterly ignorant of the fact that their religion was a copycat of another religion.
So they're utterly ignorant of the fact, but I don't know, they just seem to represent such a powerful majority of, I don't know, in the documentary you mentioned that there are enough evangelical Christians to, in effect, elect a president. I mean, do you think someone, if I ran for president and said that Dionysus told me to wage war in Iraq, do you think that would fly at all?
No, I don't think it would, strangely enough, even though there really would be no difference in a significant way whatsoever from saying that, you know, Dionysus or Isis told me to do this, or Osiris told me to do this, and or Jesus told me to do this. But, you know, you're considered insane if it's any other god but God, or some one of the other, you know, accepted religions today.
And so do you think there are steps that we can take to, you know, get this just like this Jesus favoring out of the government and out of mainstream society? I mean, is there anything we can do to stop the Christians at this point?
Well, I don't think we need to stop the Christians so much as we need to stop, we need to improve our dialogue and the way that we talk with each other. I mean, I think there's a hope for Christianity, and it's essentially when we put the Bible on the same shelf as where it belongs with the other books of mythology, that we respect and will still respect the Bible, but we don't consider it to be this inspired book that was written by some all-powerful God. You know, it obviously wasn't. You know, I think that we can still have a Christianity that's, you know, maybe involves rituals and all of that. It's just this belief in the impossible and this, you know, this total denial of the obvious that Christianity requires now. That's what we have to get rid of. And I think we can, and it is basically going to require people to be people who know, and especially liberals who are sometimes of too weak need on this. We need to recognize that the only way to eradicate madness from our dialogue is to confront it. And it's uncomfortable to do that. People get very angry and they yell at you, and it's not considered polite, but we need to do it. When somebody at a dinner party starts talking about, you know, their belief in and their faith, and it's, they're making claims that are clearly false, and all you do is silently roll your eyes and look the other way, you need to confront that person and embarrass them, because that's taboos like that is how we improve our conversation. You know, that's why it's not considered, you know, if you're in a group of doctors and somebody says, you know, let's talk about phrenology, which is this, you know, study of the size of the brain and all that. You know, when a group of doctors, somebody brings up some crackpot idea from the past, they're censured for that. You know, there's a social cost to being that ignorant and being that mad. And we need to do that in our conversation with religious people, too. We need to treat them like the, you know, they're not mad, but they're expressing these insane ideas. We need to call those ideas what they are, which is insane.
And since it is now, well, we're in the season of consumerism and, well, the solstice, which is what I think is actually happening on the 24th or 25th now, I'm wondering, what are your views on, well, Christmas?
Oh, I like Christmas. I'm enjoying the Christmas season. Our company, Beyond Belief Media, actually did declare war on Christmas. But that was more because there's all these conservative Christians saying there's a war on Christmas and there wasn't. So I didn't want them to be liars anymore. So we declared war on Christmas so they wouldn't be liars and there would actually be a war. But I do love Christmas is a fun season, and I don't think there's anything wrong with using some old piece of mythology that as an excuse to have a party. There's just nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, Valentine's Day is fun. I don't believe in Cupid, but Valentine's Day is fun too.
So you don't think there's a problem with using the phrase "Merry Christmas"?
I personally don't have any problem with it at all. No.
Okay.
Speaking of another holiday, actually, you also mentioned in the movie there was that the first Easter actually happened in 2400 BC, which is, well, that means Jesus wasn't born on or died on Easter?
Well, if you think about early civilizations and what they would have developed their religions out of, I mean, clearly there wasn't really a God who came down and walked around and told people what to do the way it says in the Old Testament. And, you know, obviously there were cultures in other areas where the Old Testament doesn't cover anyway. But we don't have a lot to go on, but if you just use your imagination and think about what, especially an agricultural civilization, what kind of rituals and religions they would invent, it mostly had to do with the movement of the sun and the other celestial bodies in relationship to them and what that would mean as far as the seasons changing, what that would mean for their crops. You know, their religion actually had meaning because you had to know what the sun was going to do. We had to know when the seasons were going to turn because your livelihood would depend on it. So they invented these stories to help them remember. And that's why you have so many stories predating Jesus where there's a sun, with a son of God, S-U-N, or a glowing God, which is often how Jesus is represented, the sun essentially dying for 3 days, which is what it does in the sky for 3 days. It stays in the same place, and then it starts moving up relative to, if you study the sun, it does what Jesus does for 3 days. It stays down, and then it goes up. And when that point happens, it's a very important point. If you're planting your crops, and you need to know when that happens. So essentially, this whole dying and rising Savior came out of the movement of the sun in the sky.
That's very interesting.
A pretty clear line from that to Jesus and all of the other ones.
Just to switch topics a little bit and talk about like some of your upcoming projects and some of your current projects, you are actually, you're very much against copyright laws, I hear.
I'm not against copyright laws. I just think that right now the copyright extremism exemplified by, say, the Motion Picture Association or the RIAA, I think that's hurting our culture quite a bit. And so I'm for copyright reform more than, copyright abolition.
Okay. So you started a creative, Free Cinema, what was it? Yeah. And you talk about this is basically releasing movies for the raw material. What you did it with one of your movies, you released it for free for people to use, but you still have your own version of it, and that's copyrighted, right?
Yeah, the movie Nothing So Strange that I made before The God Who Wasn't There is basically, as far as I know, the first open source movie, which means the source material that made the movie, the raw footage that we shot and that we own, has been released for anybody to use. There's no copyright on it, so you can make your own movie out of that footage, which is very similar to the open source software movement, where you can copyright your own piece of software, but you make the underlying code available so anybody else can use it for their software.
And that seems to be actually pretty popular now, since I think what most people want is more creativity rather than more laws dictating, or getting more people rich in some sort of conformist ways where, like, you have to pay this amount of money to get this, and then you can't really do anything with it. You can't even copy or make a copy for yourself at this point of, like, movies at home because it is, it's illegal and they'll take you away.
Yeah, it really serves nobody's purpose except the major media companies, and even them, it only serves their short-term interest in making as much money out of us as possible in the short term.
What is on your weblog, actually mentioned recently, today, you mentioned the Creative Commons campaign. What is this?
Well, Creative Commons is this great organization that was started by Lawrence Lessig, who wrote a book called The Future of Ideas and another book called Free Culture, as well as other books. But Lawrence Lessig is one of the biggest proponents of a free culture, meaning a copyright reformed culture. He's not for copyright abolition either. He's for copyright reform and having our copyright laws make sense. And Creative Commons is this organization that he created that you can use to license your own work. If you're a creator of anything at all, a movie, a book, a weblog, anything, you can license it under a Creative Commons license, so you can let people know that you're not a copyright extremist, that they can use what you wrote in their own work or use what you shot in their own work. And it provides several licenses, including a sampling license, that you can use to let people know to what degree your work is available, and you won't come after them and sue the hell out of them just for quoting you.
That's good to know. I'm actually curious about a couple of your upcoming projects. One of them, The Beast, which is actually, I guess, kind of a follow-up to The God Who Wasn't There in a way, or
yes, it is
derivative of it. What's the movie about?
The Beast is the movie I started working on a while back, and The God Who Wasn't There, the documentary, actually came out of working on this fictional movie, The Beast. It's about a Christian high school girl named Danielle who comes into possession of the irrefutable evidence that Jesus didn't exist. Her father is an archaeologist. He discovers it, gets it to her, then he disappears. And it's about this 16-year-old girl who is a Christian, a born-again, believing fundamentalist Christian, who comes into possession of this evidence. And the movie kind of has two parallel plot lines. One is her struggle with her own realization that Jesus isn't real at all, and she's a fundamentalist Christian. And also, physically, her peril as fundamentalist Christians try to get that document, destroy it, and destroy her if they have to. It's a movie that's intended for a younger audience to so that the Jesus myth theory reaches younger people, especially high school kids, right at the point where I think they're most open to becoming atheists and essentially leaving the madness of their parents' religious convictions.
Your other project that I saw on IMDb actually was Bat Boy, and you actually were responsible. You were one of the people that co-wrote the original musical for that. And I'm just wondering, is the movie going to be just basically the musical, but in movie form?
John Landis is going to direct the movie version of Bat Boy, and my co-authors Keith Farley, Lawrence O'Keefe, and I have written a script for him that he likes, and his plan and our plan is essentially to make the movie pretty faithfully a version of the stage musical. Landis likes it. It's a pretty cinematic musical as it is, so it will substantially be Bat Boy the musical that people might have seen in New York or London.
When I heard about it, I was quite amazed by it. If you walk through like a grocery lane, you see the Weekly World News magazines, and that was one of the pictures that just stuck in my mind from like forever. And then like later I found out that there was a musical about it, and it made it so much more, well, good in a way. less trite, instead of me just saying, oh no, Santa again killed Hitler. No, this was actually interesting, and I've listened to some of the songs, and it seems pretty interesting, although I've not seen it yet. But
Now it's in the amateur market. It's gone from, it's been released to high schools and places like that. So often, your local community theater might be doing it. There's a lot of productions going on around the U.S. right now.
So why Bat Boy?
Well, we were the three authors. We were pretty intrigued when we saw Bat Boy, the half bat, half boy, on the cover of the Weekly World News. And we just started joking around about why don't we tell his story as a musical, and then said, well, maybe it's a tragic life story of Bat Boy. And eventually we ended up putting together, a tragic tale of his life with some songs, and it just became this kind of phenomenon, Bat Boy the musical. We staged it in a little 45-seat theater in L.A., and over the years it's gone on to, big houses in London and New York and elsewhere.
Well, cool. Thank you very much. Thanks for talking to us. This is if you want to find out more about the movie God Who Wasn't There, which is available now on DVD, you can go to www.thegodmovie.com or just do a search for Brian Fleming on Google or IMDb.
And thank you a lot, Brian, for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Yes.
Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
No problem. Yeah, have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
You have a Merry Christmas, too.
Thank